Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Wednesday, June 8, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Today we're doing a special preview broadcast. Please note that our regular weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com will be every Monday live from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Our shows will also be live and archived on drsaputo.com.
You'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And today, her humor will shine through as it always does, my love.
Ho, ho, ho.
Is the FDA right about breast thermography in saying that there's no evidence to justify its use in breast cancer screening?
We also, in our great show for you today, will be including, should everyone be using aspirin to prevent heart attacks and strokes?
And lastly, do we need placebo in scientific studies? Those are the highlights, but we've got many other things that we'll be doing on the show today.
And we'll be taking your calls and any health questions you may have, or if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Hey, Vicki, this is our premier radio show on the Progressive Radio Network. It's great to have a new audience. It's great to be with you all out there. Thank you for joining us.
Women have been being bombarded with a message to get annual mammograms. I mean, we hear about this from our doctors. It's recommended by the American Cancer Society, television, the ads, walks for the cure, and movie stars, and the talk shows. Even sometimes I've noticed on some of these talk shows, they'll go down and get the mammograms together. But we need to ask if they're safe. And what about the radiation, and are they accurate? You know, we don't hear about the false positives and the false negatives very much. And there is another test that's safe, and it's more accurate for women under 50. So why is its value being concealed? So I want you, Dr. Saputo, to tell us about the latest article in the journal Watch slandering breast thermography and your retort.
Yes. I was stunned when I saw this. Actually, not too much, because, you know, the FDA and the government system and the mammography people, the American Cancer Society, they're like, they have like a conspiracy that really wants to keep things as they are, because it's about what? Keeping the status quo. It's about keeping money where it is. It's not about bringing new things out, because that cuts into what? Market share. So when Journal Watch came out with this article on June 3rd of this year, and it started talking about the fact that they thought that there was no evidence to support that breast thermography was something that we should be doing in clinical practice as a standalone test, or for that matter, really at all, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because I just happen to know the history of what happened in that story. And back in 1982, guess what? The FDA approved this test, and it still stands today as an FDA-approved test that we should be using in our practice, according to the FDA, as an adjunct to mammography. That's at least a start. But the real problem is that back in 2004, this came up again to the FDA as a standalone test, and it made the final committee, and the final committee vote was 5-4 against having it as a standalone test. Now, when the people from the FDA came out, and that was a Dr. Barr there, a Dr. Helen Barr, who is the director of the Division of Mammography Quality and Radiation Program in the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health, stated, "While there's plenty of evidence that mammography is effective in breast cancer detection, there is simply no evidence that thermography can take its place." Well, maybe, Dr. Barr, there's just a little. When you vote 5-4 against something in the final committee, guess what?
You have to think about who voted. You need to ask who voted.
Absolutely. That's the question. But it means at least four people thought it was a good idea. So when you say there's no evidence, hello, there's at least four people out of the nine who said this is something that is really a good thing to do, and we're going to vote to have it as a standalone test for mammography. And then you have to look at what the FDA did. It's back to its old tricks again. It puts three people out of the five who voted against it as people who have a conflict of interest, because they're connected in some way to what? The mammography industry.
How can they even allow that in a vote? I mean, that's so unethical. It's just not even fair.
Can you imagine, as connected with the mammography industry, voting for breast thermography and then going to work on Monday morning and saying, well, guys, I voted for breast thermography. How long do you think that job would last for you, or that conflict of interest? How long would that sustain?
Well, I think for our listeners, it's good to go over what breast thermography is.
Absolutely. This is a test. It's non-invasive. There's no radiation. You don't have to do 1,800 mammograms to save one life. It's more sensitive than a mammogram. And it's something you could do in privacy, where there's nobody there to be watching while you're doing it.
Well, your breasts aren't being squished or flattened either.
We'll talk more about
that
later.
Doesn't hurt.
And so what we're doing is we're measuring the infrared light that the body emits, that the breast emits. And then we use a very sensitive scanner, an infrared scanner, that picks up all that radiation, okay, that's coming out, that infrared radiation that's non-ionizing. It's not like an X-ray. It's just emitting light, and I call that radiation, but non-ionizing radiation, so it's totally safe.
Which is totally different from what a mammogram emits.
Oh, totally different than an X-ray. Yeah, that's right, because we know that when you do those 1,800 mammograms to save one life, you're probably going to cause 1 to 2 cancers.
But why is it that the doctors say when you get a mammogram that there's not very much radiation?
Well, I mean, they're not recognizing that the amount of radiation that is being delivered is only being delivered to the breast. It's not the whole body. So if you look at whole body radiation, yeah, it's far more concentrated. So even if you were getting just the same amount as a chest X-ray, which is what they say, it's all being concentrated in two small places, okay, rather than the whole chest. So now you see some of the reasons why. But at any rate, to go on with this story, we measure the amount of infrared light that is emitted by the breast. And when you do that, the breast cancers that are there will light up because they emit a lot more infrared light than normal tissue does.
Because of the extra blood flow from the angiogenesis that's there.
Exactly.
When you have cancer, that's what happens.
That's exactly right. So what you have is a test that's very sensitive. I would say it picks up 95% of the cancers, and there's a lot of data out there to support that. In the mainstream literature, I'm not talking about complementary and alternative medical journals now, and if you're looking at accuracy, it's got to be in the range of about 90%. So you're not going to get all the false negatives and false positives that you do with a mammogram and a lot of the other tests that are done there.
Which are so distressing to women, plus they lead to extra biopsies and other types of therapies.
Right. There's a lot of psychological challenge. And there's a lot of expense. There's an immense expense related to it. So when we're looking at this test, I'd have to say that we're looking at a test that's a good one that should be brought forward into clinical practice. And it should be something that replaces, in my opinion, the mammogram for women under the age of 50. Because let's get real about this. We're the only country in the world that supports doing a mammogram in women under the age of 50. Why? Because the breast is very dense in young women, in premenopausal women. And when it's very dense, it's like flying over the North Pole in an airplane and looking for polar bears in the snow.
Because that's a good description.
Yeah, there's not much difference, okay, in the density of a breast cancer and someone who has fibrocystic disease or just very dense breasts. Past the age of the menopause, the mammogram is a pretty good test. And I support doing that from time to time.
Along with the breast thermography?
Yeah, 1 year do one, and the next year do the other. And that way you'll cut back on your radiation dose, and you'll have a good way to be doing two tests that can complement one another. So we should be looking at this test as a real positive thing and something that can help us a lot in our diagnostics and in our screening.
I remember back in November of 2009 when the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force recommended that women should start regular breast cancer screening with mammograms at age 50 and not at age 40.
Yeah, boy, that
caused a lot of uproar.
Well, I was proud of Dr. Otis Brawley, who is the chief medical officer, okay, who is on this, who is reviewing this topic. And what he did is he came out in the New York Times, no less, okay, saying that the practices that were used by the American Cancer Society or endorsed by them led to treating too many people whose cancer would spontaneously clear by itself and would miss too many of those that are lethal. And, of course, within hours, he recanted this courageous declaration and a shocking reversal that was posted on the American Cancer Society website.
Well, that was kind of inconvenient for the American Cancer Society and also for Big Pharma, because they're the one that make money off of breast cancer.
When you look at the fact that about 25% of the cancers, 20 to 25%, are called ductal carcinoma in situ, what's happening is that you're treating a lot of people who don't really have cancer. And so when you're doing that, you're making an awful lot more money for the people who are providing the chemotherapy, the surgery, doing the mammograms, all the other tests that are involved. So we have to remember that over-treatment is something that's a serious problem. And when only 2% of the ductal carcinomas in situ are an issue because they turn to cancer, the other 98% or 99% do not, you're talking about big money when you're looking at 20 to 25% of all the cancers being ductal carcinoma in situ that don't need to be treated.
Well, the other thing is, too, is that maybe it's good for people to talk about the American Cancer Society or to hear about the American Cancer Society, because everybody respects so much what they do, and people that die leave their, you know, money to it, and they tell people to make donations to the American Cancer Society instead of flowers and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the American Cancer Society is very closely connected to Big Pharma.
Absolutely. Now, they're in bed with AstraZeneca. That we know for sure. We covered this a year or two ago on Coast to Coast Radio with George Noring. This was a shocking expose to find out that AstraZeneca was funneling millions of dollars through the American Cancer Society to build some facilities that could be used to provide chemotherapy to women who live too far to centers where they could get chemotherapy so they could actually live there. And they spent in the range of $100 million or $125 million trying to provide these services, and they made in the range of billions of dollars in return. So it sounded like they were really doing something that was great, but they didn't tell the whole story of the finances. And so we exposed that at that time. So we've got a huge system that's built on return on investment. It's built on how much money do I make? It's built on greed. It is not built on how can I provide the best service at the best cost and be fair and treat only those people that need it. So when we're looking at breast thermography as an adjunct or as an independent test in this setting, this is a giant step forward. And I'll have to say that most of the radiologists who I have talked to are semi-open to it. And I can remember putting on a conference with about 150 people and invited the best breast thermographer in the country at that time, which was Dr. Bill Hobbins, an MD from Minnesota, along with the two top mammographers who were in our local area. And we had a discussion about should breast thermography move forward. And at the beginning, the radiologists were absolutely certain that we're science-based and we don't want to take anything that we're going to use in our system that's not science-based, and where's the data? And after listening to it for about 5 minutes, Bill stood up, looked at them and said, look, fellas, you don't know the literature. And he started quoting articles from the mainstream that were supporting exactly that mammography shouldn't be used and that breast thermography should be used. By the end of the meeting, both of the mammographers agreed that they should start and include breast thermography at their hospitals.
And once they got back to their hospitals, they didn't.
No. The problem was is they didn't know enough about it. They weren't comfortable recommending something they weren't sure about. They knew that back in the 70s, breast thermography was a fairly hot item and that it was something that they thought would be a reasonable thing to do, but there wasn't enough research done at that time. And so an awful lot of false positives were found, and too many women were having surgery that didn't have breast cancers. But guess what? Over time, over 30 years or more, 35 years, we've had some technology breakthroughs. We can now measure to about a 50th of a degree centigrade, an infinitesimal amount of heat differential here, very accurately using the latest breast imaging devices that we have.
And also, you know, back to when they were recommending getting mammograms at 50 instead of 40, there was a lot of criticism about that. And one of the things was that they thought it was because they were trying to save money for the insurance companies, and it really didn't have to do with that, because if you start getting a mammogram at age 40 instead of 50, that's highly increasing your exposure to radiation. But now with breast thermography, There's no radiation, so when do you recommend that women start getting a breast thermography test?
Well, it depends on the situation.
It's also, by the way, called mammotherm rather than mammogram.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, see, I think it depends on the person. If you're suspicious about something, that should be the first test you do, and it might even mean doing a baseline test at age 25 and seeing what the patterns are, particularly in women who have a high risk for developing breast cancer. Otherwise, I'd say at about age 40, that would be a reasonable thing to do. And then to continue to follow it over time, because what you have is like a thermal fingerprint from a breast thermogram. So you have very sensitive and accurate information that stays for a period of years. And when it changes, okay, so that it goes to something that's different, then you have to start paying attention to what are those changes, what do they mean? And very often we can differentiate between changes that occur with hormonal shifts. People who have fibrocystic disease, for example, you have to keep, or people who have cancer, and you have to keep in mind that the breast thermogram is a test of physiology, okay? It's how the breast is functioning. It is not a test of anatomy. And all the other tests that we use for breast cancer screening or for diagnostics are anatomical. So at the very worst, we should be using breast thermography in addition to the tests of anatomy, which would be the mammogram, the ultrasound, and the MRI. So what we should be doing is looking for a partnership. We can work together, and we can do what I would call integrative practice that taps from the best of all fields rather than just using a system that does one or the other. I think both sides need to be open-minded. And I certainly don't want to just agree that breast thermograms in terms of their literature and what's published on a lot of websites is accurate. There are people who are publishing things to do breast thermograms that are outrageous. They're saying things like you can make a diagnosis of breast cancer 5 or 10 years before you can a mammogram. That's poppycock. That's not true at all.
What is true?
Maybe 6 months, maybe a year. Anything that you do that might pick up something.
Well, 6 months or a year is a good thing.
Yes, but the beautiful part about it is you're not just picking up those cancers that are the ones that are small that might spontaneously disappear on their own. You're picking up the ones that are physiologically active, the ones that have lots of heat coming out because there's a lot of neoangiogenesis, a lot of new blood vessel growth. So these are the ones that breast thermography adds a lot to. What we don't want to do is have something that's a more sensitive test like an ultrasound, like an MRI, because the MRI picks up all kinds of stuff. And if you pick up those very early cancers, we know that a lot of them are going to go away by themselves. The ones that will go away are the ones that don't have a lot of physiological activity. So this test becomes even more important at differentiating them. And so the very least I would do is do both tests. But the problem is that if you do a mammogram on somebody under the age of 50 who has dense breasts or who has fibrocystic disease, where the risk of cancer is 4 or 5 times above people who don't have fibrocystic disease, now you've got a dilemma because you're going to be finding all kinds of lumps and bumps that you don't know what they mean. And we can't do that. So we've come a long way over the last 40 years. And breast thermography.
The other thing that I think is really, really cool is that this article came out in this journal, Watch. You got heated up about it.
Oh, when I read that.
And you sent them a retort, and they actually published that right afterwards. And this all just happened within the last week.
Exactly. So the journal is called Journal Watch, and you can look it up on the Internet. And if you go to the blog part of it, you'll see my response to it. It's also on Mike Adams' site on naturalnews.com, so it's something that I think is really worthwhile looking at, because where are you going to find responses like that? Who knows the history of how things unfolded? Who's been involved with that technology himself? Who's written some articles on it? I mean, I wrote an article in the Townsend Letter some time ago that talked about beyond mammography, and it summarized all the different ways that you could do an evaluation to screen for breast cancer. And certainly, I think we're looking at a system that works when we're looking at breast thermography. So I think it's time for your 2020 tip, Vicki. And so we'll be looking at that. And when we come back, keep in mind that you want to call 888-874-8255. 888 if you have a question about anything we've been talking about or want to join in our conversation. That's 888-874-4888.
And how are we feeling today? I have a tip from this, How Are We Feeling Today? By Catherine Hammer.
A little humor, eh?
It's called the boob poem.
Uh-oh.
For years and years, they told me, be careful of your breasts. Don't ever squeeze or bruise them and give them monthly tests. So I heeded all their warnings and protected them by law, guarded them very carefully, and I always wore my bra. Well, after 30 years of astute care, my gyno Dr. Pruitt said I should get a mammogram. Okay, I said, let's do it. Stand up here real close, she said. She got my boob in line. And tell me when it hurts, she said. Ah, yes, right there, that's fine. She stepped upon a pedal. I could not believe my eyes. A plastic plate came slamming down my hooters and a vise.
Oh, Vicky.
My skin was stretched and mangled from underneath my chin. My poor boob was being squashed to Swedish pancake thin. Excruciating pain I felt within its vice-like grip. A prisoner in this vicious thing, my poor defenseless tit. Take a deep breath, she said to me.
Oh, right.
Who does she think she's kidding? My chest is mashed in her machine and woozy I am getting. There, that's good, I heard her say. The room was slowly swaying. Now let's have a go at the other one. Ha! Have mercy, I was praying. Well, it squeezed me from both up and down. It squeezed me from both sides. I'll bet she's never had this done to her tender little hide. Well, next time that they make me do this, I will request a blindfold. I have no wish to see my knockers getting steamrolled. If I had no problem when I came in, I surely have one now. If there had been a cyst in there, it could have gone kerpow. This machine was created by a man. Of this I have no doubt. I'd like to stick his balls in there and see how they come out.
Oh, my gosh. That's amazing, Vicky. Where did you find that? That's awesome.
Oh.
That doesn't matter. I think it's really... It's...
No, but I just said it when I started out. It's from And How Are We Feeling Today by Catherine Hammer.
Well, I think that's great. You know, it puts a little humor into things, and humor goes a long way because we kind of smile as we listen to things that are outrageous. We laugh a little, but it sinks in, and we understand what's going on.
Yeah, there are lots of other stories and jokes about mammograms, but, you know, a lot of things that are jokes.
And oh, true to them.
Don't end up being as funny as they are.
No, there's not. Okay, the number here, Prescriptions for Health, is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health and want to join in the conversation, give us a call. All right, what else is new in the news, Vicki?
Well, many take aspirin thinking that they're preventing a heart attack or a stroke because aspirin thins the blood. But what about when people don't have a history of heart disease? I mean, is it worth the risk of the side effects, and does it prevent a heart attack and a stroke?
Well, that's a good point. See, we're looking at the difference between what's called primary and secondary prevention. Primary prevention means that we're using aspirin in the general public to try and prevent people from getting heart attacks and strokes. And so we understand that that's different from secondary prevention, which means you've already had a problem with a heart attack or a stroke. And now we're recommending that you take aspirin because maybe it will have more of an impact. And, of course, we know when we study the difference between what aspirin does in primary and secondary prevention, there's a lot.
Well, but it depends on who studies it also.
Well, that's true,
whether
too.
Whether it's funded or not and who it's funded by.
Well, the data on the use of aspirin that justifies its use – certainly for primary prevention, is very flimsy. In fact, in general, most organizations don't recommend the routine use of aspirin for people who've never had heart disease and don't have a lot of risk factors for it. And I think that's good advice because aspirin is not the most safe thing to do. Why would you want to take a drug that if you took for a year just a dose of 81 milligrams, which is a baby aspirin size, why would you do that if you knew that about 30% of the time you're going to have an ulcer in your stomach that was about a quarter of an inch or bigger?
And how misleading to call it a baby aspirin.
Yeah, really. And, you know, I can see taking that risk maybe in somebody who has heart disease, who is at risk for another heart attack or stroke. And I could see using it in somebody who has an acute coronary syndrome where they've got chest pain that's unstable, or they're having a TIA and they're having symptoms of a stroke.
Chest pain.
But let's get real. I mean, what is it that we're really looking for when we're taking aspirin? We're looking for anticoagulation. Well, if aspirin has side effects that can be lethal, because we're talking about GI bleeds that are major bleeds, we're talking about hemorrhagic strokes, and then we're looking at all the side effects that you see, which we'll talk about in a minute, wouldn't it be a good idea to have comparative studies that look at all the different kinds of anticoagulation that are out there that we could use? Wouldn't that be a good idea?
And wouldn't it be a good idea to compare them also with things that are natural, like fish oil and ginkgo biloba and some of the other
things? Yeah, nattokinase and lumbrokinase. These are powerful anticoagulants. And nobody's done that because, let's face it, our national...
Not a moneymaker to sell nutritional
well, that's
supplements.
Right. Well,
it is a moneymaker, but not like pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's right. I think the National Institutes of Health has let us down. This is supposed to be the research organization for the country. It's the one that should be doing the studies that don't have conflicts of interest. It's the one that shouldn't have ties with Big Pharma or the medical industry, the technology industry. It's the one that should be doing the comparative studies. I can understand why a drug company or a technology industry company would not want to spend any money on that, because why should they? It doesn't promote their product unless integrity is something that's important to them. So when you're looking at comparative studies, they're not done. And you have to look at things like the supplements that I've mentioned, the nattokinase, the lumbrokinase, the ginkgo biloba, the fish oil, and ask yourself the question, is there data behind it that supports it? The answer is a clear yes. And are there side effects to these? Generally not. You look at nattokinase, lumbrokinase, which are powerful anticoagulants that are much like using heparin, which is far superior than some of the drugs that we're using in mainstream medicine, or using fish oil. You don't see much in the way of side effects. You don't see the GI bleeds. You don't see the hemorrhagic strokes anywhere near as much as you will with the drugs that we use. So why not do those? I mean, they're the things that we should be looking at that are the most important ones that will help to protect us. And we need that kind of protection safely. And that's why we should be looking at using fish oil or some of these other approaches in combination where we have somebody who is going to have primary prevention, meaning never had a problem, but you'd like to stop it from occurring in the first place.
Well, can we talk a little bit about these nine large trials that were done and the meta-analysis on these trials that were done on the aspirin?
Yeah, absolutely. And what this study found, okay, you need to know there's not a single study that's published by itself that shows that aspirin is valuable in anybody. Not one single study. And the only way we get that information to be considered is when we do what's called a meta-analysis, which means we look at the biggest studies that are out there and try and get enough people, case studies to show that there might be a small difference based on large numbers of people in the study. So what they took, the Bayer aspirin people did, and an independent group did. There were two studies done that were meta-analyses of the same nine studies. And you can guess what happened. The Bayer people came out and said, yep, it works. It's great. You should be using it. The independent study.
Whether you're healthy or not, huh?
Yeah. The independent study said, well, we're not so sure because I don't think that that's the deal. So that's what we're looking at is that kind of data. When you figure that 1,100 aspirin takers, okay, will have to take their aspirin for 4 to 10 years to prevent one death. That's a heck of a lot of people who are going to be at risk of the complications of aspirin. And then you look at the number of people who are going to be dying from this. You're looking at somewhere like about 435 people. So we're looking at a huge amount of aspirin that has to be given.
And look at the price tag of what the side effects are. I mean, if you're only preventing one death, or you're only preventing one heart attack, and you're getting nine bleeding ulcers and four major bleeds, there's more complications from the aspirin than there are from the benefits.
Yeah, well, that's right, and that's the problem that
you're
seeing.
And then there's other side effects besides bleeding. You know, you mentioned the hemorrhagic stroke, but what about the asthma and that Samter syndrome?
Back in that a minute. It's time for a short break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabut here with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you want to call it, is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888.
Source for all things progressive.
Today marks the beginning of a beautiful friendship, because the stronger my heart gets, the stronger my pen gets.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
The Progressive Radio Network is the home for progressive minds. It's the place where progressives get together to discuss important topics with informed opinions, minus the agenda. PRN is the place for fresh, stimulating, commercial-free radio content from leading progressives all over the world every day. The Progressive Radio Network, making the world a more informed place, one mind at a time.
Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, The John Rappaport Show.
Progressive Radio Network, the number one radio station for progressive minds.
You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuta here with Nurse Vicki. We're on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks for joining us. If you have a question about your health or would like to chime in the conversation, the number here is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888.
So we were talking about asthma and nasal polyps and how those can be serious and lead to what we call Samter syndrome if you take aspirin.
Right. So we're looking at the side effects of aspirin. Are they significant? Do you have to worry about it? Can we put aspirin in the water, like a lot of pharmaceutical companies would like to do with a lot of drugs? Because why? It sells
more. Let everybody bleed.
Let everybody bleed. And yes, you'd prevent a few heart attacks, you'd prevent a few strokes, but you'd have a lot of problems with a lot of other complications that we see from that. So we're looking at things like the GI bleeds, the perforations, problems with hemorrhagic strokes, people who have asthma and nasal polyps, the so-called Samter syndrome, of which there are millions of people in this country. You put them on aspirin, what happens? A lot of times they have a severe asthmatic attack that can be lethal. So it's not safe to use it in them.
And then maybe we could talk for a second about what Reye syndrome is. And when they say children are not supposed to take aspirin, children includes infants to 19-year-olds.
Yeah, really. So that means kids.
That's a big span.
It means people under the age who are not adults. That's when they're talking about children. And what happens there is this is often a lethal condition where if you give aspirin in the setting where somebody's had chickenpox or a viral syndrome or something like the swine flu, which another big story in itself we'll talk about sometime, then the risk for Reye syndrome comes up. And, of course, it causes a central nervous system disaster and organ failure in almost every organ system in the body.
And that's when people want to take it is when they have the flu.
Exactly.
Well, also, what happens if somebody takes an aspirin along with a nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drug? What happens?
Isn't that a good point? Exactly what you don't want to have happen. You negate the effect of the aspirin, which is supposed to anticoagulate you. So if you use aspirin along with something like Advil or Aleve or Motrin or Celebrex or any of those drugs, you lose the anticoagulant effect. And what do you have? It's a synergistic chance for developing complications, which means it's going to be even worse. Then we have the allergic reactions that occur with aspirin, too. Things like anaphylaxis or swelling of your face called angioedema, where your throat can swell up and actually close.
And your lips get fat.
Right.
It's very serious. If that does happen to you, you need emergency attention.
Right now. And it's the same thing. You get hives. So when you're talking about using aspirin across the board, you're really looking at something that you have to question. I think used on occasion in some settings, I might go for it.
Like if you're having a heart attack.
Yeah, you might. But in a setting where you don't have an emergency like that, my approach is to use the safer things that are anticoagulants and then to actually measure to find out what kind of anticoagulant effect you're getting. Because just because you're taking aspirin doesn't mean you're going to get anticoagulation. And just because you're taking some supplement, which would include fish oil and lumbrokinase and nattokinase, et cetera, doesn't mean that you're getting an anticoagulant effect. So how do you tell that? Well, in the mainstream, we don't do anything. We just assume that it's going to work. But there is a test called a live blood cell analysis that's fantastic. It's really a wonderful way to assess to find out whether or not you've got a problem that's interfering with your anticoagulation.
Well, not only that, it's a kind of a fun test because they put your live blood on video and you can see it. And you can see if it's sticky. You can see if there's patterns, if it clumps together, if there's parasites in it, if there's bacteria in there.
So what you're doing is using a dark field microscope at 10,000 power. And you're looking at it over time while it's alive. And so when you're doing that and you're seeing it in the living state, you can see it. Are the red cells sticking together? Are the platelets sticking together? Are there bits of clot that you see with what we call fibrin degradation products there that are causing more coagulation than you'd like to see? If the answer is yes, you know that whatever it is that you're doing is insufficient. And then you can take action to increase your anticoagulation with whatever it is that you need. So it's about titration. It's about making sure that you're getting the effect that you want and then doing that safely.
Okay, so to kind of to sum up here what we've been talking about with aspirin, it depends on who evaluates the same nine studies and realizing that the results were different. And also that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says that aspirin is recommended if there's a previous heart attack or stroke and does not recommend it if there's no history of a heart attack or stroke. And what do we say?
I say you have to really be sensible about what you do. We need more data. For now, what I'm doing with my patients is I'm looking at the old-fashioned way. I want to see the effects of whatever treatment I have is doing if it's possible. So I'm starting out with things like fish oil. I might use nattokinase. I'll often add something like ginkgo, sometimes a little vitamin E, to see if we're getting the effect that we want on that live blood cell analysis. And if indeed we do, then we go right ahead and we start looking at how we're going to manage this person with using good scientific data. Because, see, I'm a scientist, and I want to do the scientific thing. I want to be absolutely sure that the medicines that I'm using, whether they be herbs or supplements or they're pharmaceutical drugs, that they're the right approach and they're doing the job that I want it to do. Otherwise, how do you know what you're doing? And all too often what we do in the mainstream is we take an approach that is written up in the medical literature. You can't even be sure that's accurate because of all the conflicts of interest that are out there. If you want to learn more about that, by the way, I read a book called A Return to Healing. that is loaded with the karma of Big Pharma and a lot of other aspects of why healthcare is failing today in America and what we have to do to change it.
And there are a lot of interesting stories in there as well.
Right. All right, so it's time for your 2020 tip, Vicki. And remember, the number to call is 888-874-4888. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
Psychiatrist and the proctologist.
Uh-oh, this is sounding dangerous
already.
Well,
I have some best friends, and they graduated from medical school at the same time, and they decided that in spite of two different specialties, that they'd open practice together to share office space and personnel.
That's integrative practice, Vicki. That's what that is.
So Dr. Smith was a psychiatrist, and Dr. Jones was the proctologist, and they put up a sign reading, Dr. Smith and Dr. Jones, hysterias and posteriors. The town council was livid, and they insisted that they change it. So the doctors changed it to read, schizoids and hemorrhoids. Well, this was also not acceptable, so they again changed the sign to catatonics and high colonics.
Oh, my God.
No go. So next they tried manic depressives and anal retentives. Thumbs down. Then came minds and behinds. Still no good.
Oh, my goodness.
Another attempt resulted in lost souls and buttholes.
Oh, Vicki.
Unacceptable yet again. So they tried analysis and anal cysts. Not a chance. Nuts and butts? No way. Freaks and cheeks? Still no good. Loons and moons? Forget it. Almost at their wits' end, the docs finally came up with Dr. Smith and Dr. Jones. Odds and ends, and
Vicki.
Everyone loved it.
Yes, humor.
Isn't it fun to sort of brainstorm to try to come up with a title of anything, you know? I remember when we were trying to come up with ours for health medicine.
Oh, yes.
Maybe you could talk a minute about how that came about.
Well, people don't know what health medicine is, but it's the medicine of the future. And really what we're talking about here is a system that is preventive to start with, but also integrative, which means we're looking at how we can solve problems from the point of view of any discipline that's out there. And so what we do is we look at the mainstream approaches. We look at chiropractic, at homeopathic, at energy medicine, acupuncture, Ayurveda, whatever it is that might be adding something to how we practice. Then we look at the whole body, okay, the whole person. So we're looking at body, mind, emotion, and spirit as one thing. And lastly, we're looking at how we can treat people in terms that they want to be treated. So when you define health medicine, there are four principles: integrative, holistic, person-centered, and preventive. And that's a model we're actually using in my practice at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, California. We have a nonprofit educational foundation that I think you might want to have a look at. You can go to drsabuda.com and go to Health Medicine Forum. And you can see this nonprofit educational foundation that was started in 1994 has quite a history and has developed a new system of health care that I know is going to be what the American people want. Because let's face it, what we have in health care today is a sad scenario. We've got a profit-driven system that doesn't work. It's too expensive. More than half of us are sick with a chronic disease, and the safety has come into question now that we know from Gary Null's great work in his film Death by Medicine kills more than 900,000 people a year. So if you look at this over a period of 10 years, you're looking at 9 million people dying from the complications, a lot of them the expected side effects we know will happen with the treatments we use. That's unacceptable. We have to go back to a system that makes some kind of sense, that's going to give us an approach to taking care of people where they're taking responsibility for themselves. We look at wellness and prevention and nutrition and natural therapies. We look at lifestyle like sleep and stress reduction, maintaining a weight that's a good one. All these things are things that we should be using today. And we got none of that with the Health Care Reform Act. Okay, that was just a year or two ago. None of that at all. What we do is a reshuffling of the system we already have, which means we're going to spend more money. That means that more corporations are going to be making bigger incomes, and that's where it sits. We didn't have any of the things that I talked about, not the integrative, holistic, person-centered, or preventive model happen. What we have in today's healthcare system, which is a sick care system, is the mantra of the Greyhound bus company,
which says, driving to us.
Yeah. So do you really want to trust Big Pharma? Do you want to trust the insurance industry? Do you want to trust anybody who's involved with the technology that's making money? Do you want to trust Congress, which is as corrupt as it can be, because they're accepting, they're on the take from Big Pharma, the insurance industry, and all the rest? Do you think you can trust even medical research that's out there? You can't. And the data of all this stuff is out in one place. It's on our website, drsabuto.com. It's in the book, A Return to Healing, that I wrote a year or two ago. It summarizes what you need to know if you want to understand what's going on in this country today and why health care reform isn't happening.
And also, if you wanted to read more about health medicine.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we have another topic here that has to do with super sticky ultra bad LDL cholesterol. That sounds like
that sounds nasty.
Well, you know, scientists have discovered a more dangerous form of LDL cholesterol, and it seems to be smaller and denser and stickier. So tell us about this sticky LDL.
Well, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of cholesterol. But before I delve into that, I want to make sure people understand what cholesterol is, how it works, and what the ratios of the different types are. And it gets a little complicated, so I'm going to simplify it.
And it's also gotten a very bad rap.
Yeah. See, the first thing is you need cholesterol. You'd be dead without it. It's absolutely essential for life. No cholesterol, you're dead. Why? Because you can't make healthy cell membranes. Impossible. And you've got a football field surface area in your body of cell membranes that have to work right, or they can't regulate what gets in and out of a cell. It's absolutely necessary. Second, cholesterol is necessary to make vitamin D. No vitamin D, you're at risk for all kinds of things, hypertension, diabetes, strokes, heart attacks, you name it, cancer, immunity. They're all dependent on that.
And cholesterol is also good for our hormones.
You can't make hormones without it. All the sex hormones have cholesterol as its nucleus. So when we start talking about cholesterol as being a bad thing, it's only a bad thing when our body's in an inflamed state, and then we get what's called oxidized cholesterol. Or if we have a situation where we have too much sugar in our system, then what happens is that proteins in our body, when blood sugar levels exceed 170, start to deteriorate from the effect of the high concentration of glucose. So when the glucose concentration is high, it causes a lot of damage to proteins in the body that ages prematurely and puts us at risk for heart attacks and strokes and other forms of arteriosclerosis.
So it sounds like this would really be a lot worse for diabetics.
It's worse for diabetics, and it's worse for people who are aging who have less good mechanisms for keeping blood sugar down. So when we're talking about this super sticky, ultra bad cholesterol, what are we talking about? It's a type of LDL cholesterol of which there are about nine types. Okay, that's amazing, about nine different types. It makes more of this super sticky stuff when the blood sugar level goes above 170 and activates an enzyme called aldose reductase, which converts those high levels of sugar into high levels of a poison called sorbitol. And it's that situation that leads to the damage in type 2 diabetes and in type 1 diabetes, for that matter, as well. And so that's what leads to the diabetic neuropathy of your feet, the retinopathy of your eyes, the heart attacks, the stroke, the peripheral vascular disease,
the
kidney disease.
All the serious complications that people try to prevent when they have diabetes.
Exactly. Now, if your blood sugar levels are high, you could do two things. You can do what we said not to do if you have heart disease, which is take aspirin, because it will block the effect of aldose reductase, and you won't make so much sorbitol. And the reason I say I'm not in favor of that one, and I'm in favor of the other one, is because the other one is safe. Use a couple of grams of vitamin C. It blocks aldose reductase beautifully, too. So when we're looking at this super sticky, ultra-bad cholesterol, number one, make sure that your blood sugar levels are where they should be. And the way to do that, of course, is to measure your hemoglobin A1C, which is a marker for the average level of your blood sugar over the past 3 months, and to also make sure that you're doing what you can to make your body's blood sugar level stay down, which is what? Diet, exercise, stress reduction, adequate sleep. So what we're talking about, as we always are on this show, is about lifestyle medicine. There is no drug, never has been, and I'll predict there never will be, that can do what lifestyle does.
Now, let's talk also about the ratios of the total cholesterol and the HDL, mm-hmm. and why that's the most accurate way to judge if your cholesterol is bad or not, because a lot of times I think people just go by what their LDL cholesterol is.
Yeah, well, let's look at the history of looking at the cholesterol factor. To start with, back in the 60s and the 70s, what we did was we looked at the total cholesterol, and then we made some assumptions. We found that as we measured cholesterol levels, as they rose, the risk for developing a heart attack or a stroke rose as well. But as we studied it further, we found out that not everybody who had a high cholesterol did worse. In fact, we found that a lot of people with higher cholesterols do better. Why? Because we need that cholesterol, as we talked about earlier, to do a lot of important things. So when we're looking at the factors that comprise cholesterol, the total cholesterol, we're looking at two major ones. One is HDL, which I call happy cholesterol. It's a high-density lipoprotein. That's what HDL stands for. That's the good stuff that does what's called reverse cholesterol transport, meaning it takes the cholesterol in the plaque and in the bloodstream back to the liver so that it's not going to cause plaque. And then we have the stuff called the LDL cholesterol, which is the lousy cholesterol. That's the stuff that if it's too high, tends to cause problems.
Or sticky.
Yeah. So what's the most important thing? It's looking at the ratio of the total cholesterol to the HDL. Now, if your cholesterol is 200 and your HDL is 50, you divide 50 to 200, it goes four times. The ratio would be 4 to 1.
So anything below 4 is good.
Yeah. So if you say your HDL was 100 and your total cholesterol was 200, that ratio would be even better. It'd be 2 to 1. Now, if you have high levels of cholesterol, say your cholesterol is 300, but you had an HDL of 75. In a lot of settings, that's good news because it means your risk for stroke goes down. It means your all-cause mortality is going to be better. And there are times when you might want to treat that with some kind of pharmaceutical approach if somebody has advanced heart disease.
Well, what about statins?
Well, the statins are interesting. I don't much use them in my practice. On occasion, I will. The problem is there are too many side effects and complications. They are not the best way to reverse the problem that we have. It's sort of like treating the symptoms of the problem. It's like putting your fingers in the dike until you don't have enough fingers and the dike breaks. What you want to do is stop the process called inflammation. When there's too much inflammation in our body, what happens?
The cholesterol goes there to try to soothe it.
Exactly. So it goes to those injured places in your arteries and they form plaque. And it's the oxidized cholesterol. It's the cholesterol that's injured by inflammation that causes the problem. So it's not the cholesterol itself. It's what the inflammation does to it that's the problem. And when you're in that setting, now you need to look at how do I get rid of the inflammation? Now you're talking about what? Lifestyle. Diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep. Weigh what you should, have a meaningful purpose in your life. You do those things, you'll do the most of the time to correct the problem of inflammation. And what we do in Western medicine is say, well, what can I do if I'm not going to take responsibility myself? Where's my silver bullet?
That's the statin.
That's the statin drug.
Well, could you just talk for a few minutes, or just for a minute, uh-huh. about some of the side effects with statins? I mean, why are they so dangerous? Because a lot of people are taking statins.
If the drug companies had it their way, they'd put the statins in the water. In fact, what they're talking about is something called the polypill, which we'll talk about on another show, that's got 4 or 5 drugs in it that they want to literally put in the water. They want everybody to take it for primary prevention, which is the silliest thing I ever heard. But to answer your question, what are the side effects that you worry about with statins? Well, first of all, people with liver disease can't take it because it screws up your liver.
It depletes you of CoQ10, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Q10. The mechanism that that these drugs use, these statins use, to block the production of cholesterol, also block the production of coenzyme Q10. And when you have levels of coenzyme Q10 that are low, you cannot make ATP, which is the energy currency of the body. And so paradoxically, when you're on a statin, you put yourself at risk for something called a congestive cardiomyopathy. That means that you've got heart disease from insufficient production of energy that can be lethal. So you must, if you're going to be on a statin, you must take coenzyme Q10 with it. And I'd suggest a dose of about 200 milligrams a day taken with meal. Because it won't absorb otherwise.
And doesn't it also make people's muscles hurt?
It can make your muscles deteriorate and cause a lot of inflammation in them. And basically, studies that were done about 10 years ago now, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showed that everybody has muscle inflammation who takes a statin. Everybody. But not everybody has clinical symptoms from it. And what happens is it releases a pigment called myoglobin from muscles that, when it's released in large amounts, causes a lot of pain in muscles. That's why a lot of people on statins have pain. And if there's sufficient amounts of it, it goes to the kidney, it plugs up the kidneys, and you die in renal failure.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, well, that's why this condition called rhabdomyolysis.
You die with low cholesterol.
Well, you would, yes. And we know that as cholesterol levels get below something like 150, that you're looking at an increase in all-cause mortality. So there's a double-edged sword here, and we shouldn't be relying on drugs to do what we can do ourselves. We shouldn't be listening to those direct-to-consumer ads that tell you you need this drug. We shouldn't be listening to the medical profession that's been brainwashed by all the medical education that's offered so generously by Big Pharma. We should be looking at lifestyle medicine and doing something to change that in a way where we're really making some progress.
People might ask, well, are there supplements that I can take if I have a high cholesterol besides the healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, you could do that too. But again, it's doing the same thing as a statin, except it's just a lot safer.
Well, so, maybe what would they be?
Well, things like jujulipid, polycosinol, niacin. Yeah, there are a lot of those that are available. If you could do anything, those I think would be much safer to do.
And of course, the best thing is to live the healthy lifestyle and get at the cause of what it is.
Exactly. Well, that's brought us to the end of the show. You've been listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki signing off. Thanks for joining us. Our regular time is on Mondays from 3 to 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
And it's 12 to 1 Pacific Standard Time.
So we hope you'll join us again on Monday. Thanks for joining us today.
Have a healthy week.
Take care.